Welcome in to Big Talk, college sports with a Midwest perspective, blue collar and blue blood. As Sam Sprunger has the echo even down on it. I love that. That's Sam. I'm Dalton Shetler. Glad to have you with us here for this week. Sam, it's another pretty action-filled week because we are now really into the grind of Big Ten basketball. We talked about it. It's getting ready to kick back up the last episode. Now we're in it. I mean, we got a 20-game slate, and 18. I'm obviously – two have already been played, so 18, yes. But the point, no matter what, is we have the conference races officially on and going, and we have an all-Big Ten national championship, if you were to look at it through that prism, because it's Michigan and Washington.
Next year, the Big Ten will have the national champion residing in the conference.
Yep, 100%. And period. These two teams will play each other next year, which yes. Should be a very fun matchup to get to later on in the next season. But there's a lot to get to. Why don't we start off with the football side just because, sure. You know, given that it's the national championship coming up Monday. Mm-hmm. We talked about it last week. We gave predictions. We talked about a couple of things. And I think we have to start with a slight tip of the cap to Sam Sprunger because Sam got his prediction completely right. He picked Michigan and Washington for the championship game. So we'll take a small moment.
A golf clap. Pause. Wow.
Yeah, how about that? I got the golf hat on today. We're offering a little golf clap.
Movie. You'll never have seen it, I'm sure, but it's called Men at Work. And it's got Charlie Sheen and Emilio Estevez in it, and they are garbage men. Okay. And there's a couple of bike police officers that ride bicycles, and they're always going back and forth at these garbage men, and somebody... one of the cops made a statement to where it was like a real hard hitting, like I'm going to tell you how things are. And Charlie Sheen and Emilio Estevez look at each other and go, golf clap, you know, golf clap. And they.
So that's what it was like. But yeah,
good movie though.
Well done for you. You get the championship game right. I had Washington winning, but I had Bama winning. And boy, I mean, look, no matter how you sparse this, these were some close outcomes. I mean,
for the first time ever.
Yeah.
Both semifinals were actually competitive games.
Yeah. From that sense, the drama of it, the anticipation was great viewing. But Michigan Bama goes to overtime. Bama hangs on with a goal line stand or a stand on from the 3-yard line. Thank you. Michigan holds on. Bama fails to convert.
You're still
on that
trying to live your dream, huh?
There's a, yeah, correct. Oh yeah. Don't even get me started on that. folks in mid Michigan, in the East Lansing area have become big Washington fans over the last couple of days.
Even though Washington housed the Spartans this last year,
okay.
All of a sudden, let's go Huskies.
Totally are forgiving of that. But for Washington, they hang on in the final play to beat Texas. I mean, these games were as close as it gets. Like I said, I picked Washington win, but I also picked Bama, so I only got one out of two. Tony Hollinsworth, who was on the show last week, picked Texas and Alabama.
That's why he's not on this week.
And the crazy thing is, Tony is one play away from each of those games from being 100% right. Like, that's how close the margins were.
We were two plays away from him being right and me being completely wrong.
Yeah, and there were... and
one play for you being right.
Yeah, right. And what's crazy about it, too, is especially we talk about how close the margins were. I mean, look at that first game and all the mistakes that were in that Rose Bowl. Yeah. And the Rose Bowl was great from the aspect that it was so dramatic and a thrilling finish coming down to the wire, and it was competitive. But overall, the execution-wise of it, it was not the greatest game, but Michigan was able to prevail. But we saw so many missed snaps from Alabama. Alabama's offensive line looks lost, and they got flat-out bullied by Michigan. And it felt like a little bit like an optical illusion just to see Alabama get just beat up in the trenches. I'm not sure we've seen it in flashes this year, but I don't think we've ever seen a Bama line, a Bama front get punked under Nick Saban the way we did in this game. And it's been an issue for them all year. Like this, it's not necessarily a surprise that Michigan was going to go toe to toe with Alabama and maybe win in the trenches, but to bully them the way they did, that was jarring almost.
This tells me, and I'm not saying it should have been, To me, it doesn't matter who it would have been, but this to me says that it absolutely was fitting that Alabama shouldn't have been there, only for the fact that they came in totally unprepared. Now, they almost won the game, but I've never seen a Nick Saban Alabama team come in with that much time to prepare and look that inept and unready to play a football game, ever.
And a lot of it for me, I keep coming back to, I don't think that this team was just very good ever. And I think
talent wise, yes, but they just don't have a team.
Well, and I'm not sure that they're really, like, talent wise compared to the Bama standard. I think they fall well short.
You're absolutely correct there. I'm just saying overall, if you look at the grand scheme of things, not just, oh, that's Alabama. It's yes, they've got tons of talent, but they're not the Alabama talent they're used
correct.
To.
Correct. And that's why I think the fact that Nick Saban was even able to wheelbarrow this team to the playoffs, like, this is a pretty nice job out of this Saban and staff there in Alabama. But
I guess the fact that they beat Georgia blows my mind.
Honestly, and if you want to play the shoulda, coulda, woulda, I'm curious now, given what we just saw. I mean, I would have rather seen Georgia play Michigan. Like, obviously, you can always do the hindsight game. Like, I understand this kind of bogs things down, but Georgia's got a competent front. Like, we've seen what they can do with their offensive line. We've seen that year in, year out. Yep. Bama just didn't have that this year. I think Georgia would have been maybe the better matchup with Michigan. And I guess Georgia just shouldn't have lost their one game in 30.
Do you think Nick Saban would have let that happen? he beats Georgia and Georgia still makes it to the playoff over them. And that would have never that's inconceivable, Dalton. Come on. Come on.
And that's what, like, I know the playoffs were, this was as dramatic filled to try and fill out the field as it's ever been. And I'm not even necessarily saying the committee got it wrong, because I don't really know what the right answer was to do here. Was it to put in an undefeated Florida State team that, you know, was not at full strength?
They wouldn't have gotten blown. I don't know. People using the game that they played against Georgia as the example of, well, of course they shouldn't have been there. That's BS, because you know what? You wouldn't have had the opt outs. You wouldn't have had
25 the transfer of them or whatever it was.
Correct. There was 20, almost a quarter of the roster decided not to play in that Orange Bowl game. So don't tell me that would have been the committee made the right choice. Once there's a game that doesn't matter, there are opt-outs and transfers that happen immediately. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened to Florida State, is their roster was decimated. They were playing as a JV team against, like, the national two-time defending national champion. And it's almost the exact same thing that happened to Ohio State. They got a game that didn't matter, so opt-outs and transfers a galore happened, making that a very, very weak-looking bowl game. It didn't prove anything. Georgia and Florida State proved absolutely nothing to me.
Here's something interesting, too, because you bring up Ohio State, and they only scored the 3 points against Missouri in the Cotton Bowl and lost, I think, 14-3. I think Missouri had 14. Just reading and judging off of social media commentary, which is a dangerous game, I'm fully aware. I'm very curious, what is the temperature of Ryan Day's seat in the next year? And I understand that sounds ludicrous to say, given the fact that he's won 90%+ of his games, but people were not happy with the ineptitude that was offered in that bowl game. And it goes beyond that, obviously. It goes to the Michigan games year after year. I'm curious what happens next year. Let's say Michigan beats Ohio State for a fourth time. Like, are we having the conversation that Ryan Day gets fired?
I think so. I really do think so. Ohio State doesn't have as long of a leash as Michigan. You know, I guess they do, because they let John Cooper go for years before they let him go. But anymore, they've decided, you know, hey, look, you know, obviously, if you can't beat Michigan, you need to, you know, be considered. Maybe we can find somebody else. But yeah, I think so. With as much talk as went on to this year before they got beat by Michigan a third time in a row, I cannot imagine that if it happens a fourth time, they're going to let him come back. I really would be shocked.
And so they lose that game to Michigan, and then in that bowl game, the commentary that was offered by the fan base was visceral.
I got in arguments with Ohio State fans.
I think a lot of that emotion will be faded away by the time next season comes, because honestly, like, who really cares about a bowl game unless you're in the playoffs? I mean, nobody will hang on to that, but they'll hang on to the Michigan loss.
That was my argument, Dalton. The sky was falling that they only scored 3 points against Missouri. And I said, guys, you realize the guy they had in at quarterback was at prom last year. He was dressed in a tux, putting a corsage on his senior girlfriend. Like, he literally was in high school last year, and he was playing against the 9th best team in the country who had zero opt-outs, zero transfers, and they still struggled to beat Ohio State.
It's going to be interesting because Ohio State has set a standard. I mean, sure, they won a national championship in the last decade. They ran the Big Ten for a while. They had won 4 straight Big Ten titles. And now that they've taken a step back, things are not pleasant in Columbus. But I think that's going to be something interesting to watch heading into the next year. Outside of that, let's go ahead and preview for a moment Michigan-Washington. It's coming up this Monday night, 7:30 kick, I believe, from Houston, Texas. Michigan-Washington, what stands out to you about this matchup?
This is an offense, in my thought, that Michigan hasn't been against. They have so many weapons. Yeah, Ohio State but Ohio State didn't have a quarterback like Michael Penix Jr.
100%.
And now, he's not a running quarterback, but I saw him run an awful lot against Texas for ineffective situations. And if they can continue to do that against Michigan, I just don't know that Michigan has enough. I've stated before last week even that I think whoever won Texas, Washington wins the national championship. I still believe that. I still think Washington wins. Michigan's beaten everybody that they were supposed to, everybody that's gone in front of them, but they were also supposed to. Washington was supposed to be good, but they were supposed to lose to Oregon twice and they didn't. And they just keep beating these teams. They find ways to win. I think Washington still does that. Their offense is still so strong. And I just don't know that Michigan's got enough to stick with it. I really don't.
I don't know if I'm a bit prisoner at the moment, but when you talk about Michael Penix, who I keep coming back to, I think maybe should have been the Heisman winner this year instead of Jaden Daniels at LSU. Yeah. I don't remember. And again, maybe I'm being prisoner of the moment, a quarterback in recent history that drops the ball in a bucket better than Penix. I mean, the windows he finds to put the ball in and just dropping it over shoulders. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is as proficient as a passer as I think we've seen in recent years, unless, again, I'm just prisoner of the moment, which if you have suggestions or candidates in the comments or you, Sam, go ahead, throw them to me, because I mean,
Burrow would be the closest one in my thought. And he's not even as good as Penix is, like you said, putting it on a dime right in where it needs to go. Like, you know how quarterbacks practice throwing it to the back corner of the end zone with the bucket. Mm-hmm. Like you said, they just drop it in there. I think he does that everywhere he goes. Like, every place he throws the ball, he drops it right into the bucket. You're right.
Like, if he's throwing at a bucket 10 times, he's making it like 9. Like, as accurate as I've seen in a very long time. And it's funny you brought up Joe Burrow, because I keep thinking of this too. I keep likening and saying that this Washington receiving core is the best college football has seen since the Ja'Marr Chase, Justin Jefferson days of that 2019 LSU group. I mean, what Roma Dunze and this squad does, Bernard, I think this is about as good. Bernard, by the way, former Michigan State football player. This is about as good as a receiving core as we've seen since LSU. I can't think there's one better.
No, so, and I think that they have the Heisman Trophy winner on their team too. Yeah. It just didn't get the award, you know.
And the Washington offensive line did win the Joe Moore Award this year for the best offensive line. So you're looking at a
superseding fully rounded out group. Michigan.
Yeah, yeah. because Michigan had won two in a row. So that goes to show you, too, the currents of football is you win in the trenches. I mean, we've known it forever, but here's an example. Your last three Joe Moore winners are playing for the national championship this year, and Michigan was pretty good itself. But
Michigan wasn't a slouch this year. They just weren't as good as Washington.
Look what they did to Bama in that game. I mean, that offensive line showed up. So I think this is going to be a great matchup. I'm with you. The explosiveness of Washington's offense, I do wonder how Michigan will counter that, because Michigan, by the way, let's give credit where it's due. Defensively, unbelievably strong. That's secondary. For sure. What Mike Sainristil still did as a defensive back. Will Johnson at corner. I mean, Bama just decided wherever Will Johnson is, we're just going to go away from him on the field. Like, he was that much of a game changer in that one. Not to mention the pass rush and getting to Jalen Milroe five times in the first half. Like, this is a great Michigan defense that we're going to see. And I think that makes this matchup tremendous. Going that Washington offense that we're talking about, in certain positions, the best we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years, against a Michigan defense that was able to force Nick Saban's hand in saying, just taking away half a field with what they were able to do. I think this sets up to be an epic battle.
I think it sets up to be a very low-scoring battle, too. I think it's 17-10, you know, 21-17, something like that. It's not going to be the 30-plus each that Washington and Texas scored. It's going to be more like the, you know, the Alabama-Michigan game, where the defense is going to control the scoring, but I think Washington has too much scoring firepower than Michigan to where they're going to break through at the right time. I think Washington wins.
Well, and it's interesting too, is once the matchup was finalized that we knew it was going to be Michigan and Washington after they won. What are you shaking your head at?
That last minute and a half or 2 minutes, because I actually turned the game off when it was 9 points.
I was in Iowa City. Left a sports bar that I was watching the game at with a minute, because I'm like, oh yeah, there.
Game's over.
Two timeouts.
Two, like, you possessions. Can't really. It's over.
I walk back into the hotel room where the game was on, and I'm just staring at it like, what happened with that injury timeout? I was like, is that seriously what's going to happen? And sure enough, it was.
I have never seen an injury lead to an ending like that.
I mean, that was just bizarre.
That's the only way that game extends is an injury, and I'll be darned if Washington didn't get in an injury. It set up perfectly.
But circling back, once Washington won that game and we knew what the matchup was, somebody had asked me, what do you think? And my first initial reaction was, the good news is, if I suppose you're not rooting for Michigan in this game, Washington will never be out of the game. With a team like that, you're never out of a game. You could be down two scores in the third or in the fourth. Doesn't matter. Like, Washington is always going to have an opportunity to win this game. And I think that's something where I'm not sure if I would say that on the Michigan side. If Washington gets up by two touchdowns in the fourth, like,
you're talking about a Michigan team who didn't throw the ball in the second half against Penn State. And correct. It wasn't because necessarily they chose to. It's because they just didn't trust the throwing game maybe as much as what they should. So, yeah, I agree. If they get down two scores to Washington, it's trouble. If it's the other way, it's a bloop. Going back to my coaching days of baseball, it's a bloop and a blast is what that is. You know, I mean, anybody can put a bloop and a blast together. It's the putting together four different scores to win. And you're right. Washington, as long as they're within a couple of scores, they're in striking distance.
Mm-hmm. And what interests me too is, I mean, we paint the scenario if Michigan gets down multiple scores. I mean, that's a big if, because I imagine Michigan's going to have the ball
probably
for 20 minutes of the first half, and they're just going to run and milk that clock. And my big question is, will Washington's front be able to counter and stop the production of Blake Corum? Not stop, but slow that down enough to where they're forcing punts and getting the ball. Because if it's going to be 3 yards in a cloud of dust for Michigan and they just eat that clock, like, that's how Michigan wins this game. If they successfully run the ball against Washington, I think Michigan will be the national champions.
Well, think about the last 3 years against Ohio State.
And by the way, sorry, before you finish your point,
go ahead.
That's not a far reach. Like, if Michigan's just running the ball, like, that's something they do extremely well. Play Corum's the all-time rushing leader in Michigan history. We talked about how great that offensive line is. Like, that's a very possible target. And if they hit it, I think they win.
Well, I agree. And that's why what I was getting ready to say is the last 3 years against Ohio State, what have they done? They've run the ball at the end of the third quarter. All of a sudden, Ohio State hit a wall defensively. And that's when Michigan started spreading it out, right? Mm-hmm. That's when they won their games. Now, this year was a lot closer, and it was a one-possession game at the end, but the running game established and wore down the Ohio State defense. It can do the same thing to Washington. It absolutely can do. So the longer that defense stays on the field against Michigan, the quicker and the more tired they get near the end of the game. So it's imperative that Washington forces those punts and gets their offense back on the field, even if it's just for a little bit, a quick strike and score. Because if Washington can offensively score points, it puts the pressure on Michigan not to waste the clock, and they've got to get down and score. Yep. Well, that speeds up their offense. That means they don't run the ball as slow and methodically. It doesn't wear the defense down. So yeah, you're right. It's imperative that Washington stops and gets some punts out of Michigan, so they aren't basically hanging themselves for the end of the game.
And that's what I'm most interested to see, I think, in this matchup. I'm most excited to see Washington's offense against Michigan's defense, because I think we're seeing two of the very best units of those in the country in that matchup. But I'm most interested and fascinated to see what happens when Michigan has the ball, and can Washington slow down that Wolverine rushing attack? I think that's where the game might be decided. It's fascinated.
Secondary power against secondary power, which secondary power wins? Because if the offense for Michigan is able to extend the Washington defense, the Washington offense doesn't get on the field.
See, and here's what's interesting about it, and this is why it has some layers to it, is because it's the secondary power for Michigan, but it's only secondary in the aspect that it's one-dimensional-ish.
Correct.
Yeah. And I don't want to absolutely put Michigan in a box. Like, McCarthy made a couple throws. Wilson made a couple catches in that game, but for the most part, like, this is a rush offense, and rushing-wise, it's just about one of the best you're going to find in the entire nation. Passing-wise, if they're forced in third and longs, like, Washington wins, I think. Like, I think that's really what you're looking at. So, I mean, it's a secondary power, but only because it's not multidimensional.
No, I agree. And that's I think Washington, you would, I don't know, I won't speak for you, but I would think you might agree that if Michigan's got to rely on McCarthy to win this game, Washington's in a good
yes,
a good area right now. If they're in good shape if Michigan has to rely on McCarthy to win that game.
Yep. And that's that's all opponents can really ask for. And that's it's really not a slight to McCarthy. I hope it's not coming off that way. I just think the rushing attack is so good, and I think it's just their front foot.
It's hard to have a quarterback that good as good as the running game. It just is really hard to do. Have at facets of both games.
And meanwhile, we say that, and Jim Harbaugh says after the last game that J.J. McCarthy is the greatest Michigan quarterback all time in college football history at Michigan. You got a stink face going there in reaction to that.
I liked Elvis Gerbach, if that's a name from the past. Like, he was darn good at, I don't know, there's some guy named Tom Brady that was pretty decent at Michigan, too. I mean, don't get me wrong, he wasn't like the GOAT or anything at Michigan, but, he's pretty good once he got out.
Yeah, and he did qualify that. He said, he's got a ways to go to catch Brady in, like, the professional career, but from a collegiate career standpoint, that it's J.J. McCarthy. But, I mean, either way, however you look at the semantics, that's why this whole experience is so interesting to me, because I think if you're an opponent, you're like, make J.J. beat you. Like, take Corum and that offensive line away. That's your best shot at it.
Hey, if we're going to lose and McCarthy's going to do it, then they deserve it.
Yeah. And again, that's not a slight to McCarthy. I just hope it's getting across that we're saying that Blake Corum has more rushing touchdowns than any other Michigan running back in history. Like, and that's why history. Yeah, that's why we keep saying you want to be the other way, because as much as McCarthy's getting credit, Blake Corum and that offensive line should be getting just as much, if not more, like legacy-wise, for what they've done in the last few years. So your prediction is Washington wins?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The Huskies are the national champions, in my thought.
And then they come to the Big Ten Conference, and in the swan song of the Pac-12, they have a national champion and reign supreme. Great for them,
and we'll take the defending champion in our conference next year.
What a weird experience all of this is. Oh, my. Okay, let's go ahead and move to basketball.
Yes, sir.
Let's start here on the men's side. Let's recap a little bit what happened last night. Michigan State beat down Penn State, 92-61 on the men's side. Michigan State, yeah, Malik Hall had a career high in this one. Michigan State starting to round out into form a little bit, like the team we thought they could be before the year. We had talked a few weeks ago, and I think the consensus between us was, you think Michigan State at some point will get to the point that we thought they would be, but the question was, as long as it was delaying itself, would it be in time for Big Ten play? Would they be ready for that Big Ten grind? Because it just kept taking some time. Yep. And you just thought the process would move a little quicker. Now they're starting to round into form a little bit, and you wonder what the Big Ten looks like for Michigan State.
I'm looking right now, and I'm looking at current standings. I'm not even looking at that and doing any credence. I'm looking at win streaks, okay? Mm-hmm. We've got Purdue sitting there at 6 in a row. Nebraska, Minnesota has won 6 in a row.
We got to talk about that game last night too.
I want to, because then you get to the next level of highest wins or win streak. Okay, you've got Nebraska who sits at the top, 12-2 overall. Then you have Ohio State who's 12-2 overall. You Wisconsin 10-3. Then you have Michigan State 5 in a row, 9-5. That to me is the most telling thing, is they were sitting at 4-5. They've rattled off 5 in a row. I think the rest of the Big Ten might be in trouble.
And three of those five include Baylor on a neutral site where they just blew the doors off Baylor. It includes a tough Indiana State team. I mean, by the net rankings, this is a top 50 team. Right. Indiana State, I think, only had one loss heading into that matchup. That was just their second. And of course, a Penn State team too, which they won by 30 plus points last
and
night.
And this isn't the Penn State team of last year, but they're not just going to get bullied all the time.
They've had some games. I think they went to overtime or went to the wire with Ohio State earlier this year, mm-hmm. which Ohio State this year is having a solid year. I'm completely with you. And so for Michigan State to start rounding itself into form where the backcourt's playing a little better, the front court's rounding into shape a bit, and Jackson Kohler should be back in the next week or so. He finally got upgraded to questionable for this game. He sat out. Of course, he didn't get into the Penn State game. But that's going to be really the focal point for Michigan State in terms of their fan interest heading into this matchup where they go to Northwestern on Sunday to play the Wildcats. But if Jackson Kohler gets back into it, I mean, we mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. I think what he brings with a low post ability, it changes what the offense can do dynamically. Like, I mean, we talk about in football aspects, Michigan, you want to make them throw the ball because they want to lean so much. They're a little bit more one dynamic by nature. I mean, Michigan State's offense right now, it's pretty transition heavy. Like, they want to get out and run, and the half court is where things were getting really stagnant. But in that half court, if you have a Jackson Kohler that you can spin the ball inside to and let him work in the post, it opens a couple more things up for this Michigan State team. So I think there's a lot of reason to be excited right now for Michigan State, given the fact that they figured this out before implementing Kohler back in.
Well, and I think that was the big thing, is it appears anyways, let's say it this way, that they have figured it out before getting all the pieces back. Mm-hmm. And that makes Michigan State very dangerous moving forward because of that, because Now, I don't think throwing Kohler back in is going to throw a wrench in them figuring it out either. I think it's going to be like, oh, goodness, look what we got on top of this. Wow, we got this along with having the success that we've figured it out. You know, great. And I think, yes, I think the Big Ten has to, they had a month off of not having to deal with Michigan State. And now all of a sudden the Spartans have figured it out. And that's the last thing you want with Tom Izzo team moving towards March is them figuring it out.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, and let's go ahead now and look, because with the Big Ten, where do you see Michigan State at in the pecking order? I mean, this is projection wise. They still have 17 Big Ten games to go, but projection wise, because we came into the year and the thought was there was a class of top teams. It was Purdue and Michigan State. And then there was another group, another class, and another class. It was broken out into about four or five tiers. And over the course of the season, a lot of respect's been given to Illinois, Ohio State, some of these other squads. Where does Michigan State land, do you think, by the end of the year?
By the end of the year, I think they're number two.
Number two, okay.
I really do. I have a lot of faith in Tom Izzo and his team. Wisconsin's still trying to figure things out. They're sitting. Illinois's got the biggest question mark because you just don't know what's happening with Terrence Shannon Jr.
Yep.
You know, whatever plays out with that way. I'm not trying to get into that. It's you don't know. He's in flux right now. Whether he comes back and plays it or doesn't, he's not right now. And Illinois still trying to figure out who they are, while trying to move forward and trying to fill this gap, because, like, you know, it appeared that they had figured out and gelled, like we'd talked about. You know, Illinois, the top 10 team, you know, they play tonight against Purdue. It's the first top 10 matchup in West Lafayette since 2010.
I was going to say, we're going to talk about that game too, yes. Because that's,
yes. But my point on this is Illinois still, even though they're top 10, they're still trying to figure it out, because Terrence Shannon Jr. situation just happened not too long ago. They've only played one game since. And yeah, they thumped Northwestern. But the point being is they haven't gone against teams that are going to really put questions into their minds as to how they go forward without Shannon. And it's just, I don't know that they may be still top three or four. But I still think Michigan State moves up because they're starting to click. Michigan State's starting to click, and they're only a game behind Purdue in the standings, and they're only a game and a half out of first place behind Illinois. So, like, there's a lot happening that I think there's still plenty. 17 games left is an eternity, you know. And I think by the end of the season, Michigan State works up to number two.
Well, and here's what I find interesting, because you brought up a couple points, and I want to circle back to the game we did see them play without Terrence Shannon, which happened 3 days ago, January 2nd, which was Tuesday.
Yes.
Illinois beat Northwestern by over 30.
Yeah.
What did we see in that game where the Illini still put up 96 without their potential All-American or somebody who was on track to maybe be an All-American and Terrence Shannon Jr. before all of this hit? Like, what allowed Illinois to still be that successful?
Excuse me. I think, is it Domask or Damask?
Damask.
32 points from him is going to, you know, make a lot of things work out to be, you know, kind of okay.
11 for 15 from the floor, and we saw him put up a 30 burger against FAU earlier in the year too.
So like, you know, the cupboard's not bare in Champaign without Terrence Shannon Jr. They're still going to be a top 25 team, I think. I just don't know that they're a top 10 without him.
Yeah.
So nope. I think they're going to beat teams like Northwestern, like if they get a team like maybe Iowa at home, or, you know, some of those lower teams in the conference, and this is no knock on Northwestern. I don't think they're top tier in the Big Ten, so they're going to get some thumpings. And yes, they're going to beat some teams they shouldn't. They've beaten Purdue, so I mean, like that shows that they can play a good game. But they're going to also get beat by Chicago State, you know, which then also lends to a 30 point loss to Illinois, even though Illinois is missing their top player that on their roster. So I don't know that I read a ton into, you know, how much Illinois is not going to be missing without Junior or Shannon Junior on the team for the time being anyways, by a 30-point win over Northwestern. I think it's how they fare against the teams like Purdue. Michigan State's next for them after Purdue. So Maryland, if they have to go to Maryland, you know, those are the things, yep. Those are the games that are going to show who they are, I think, going forward.
Well, and here's what I find interesting too. Let's go back to that box score of Illinois Northwestern. Mm-hmm. So we mentioned Damask had 32. He went 11 of 15 from the floor. Quincy Guerrier had a double-double, 14 points, 10 boards in that one. Going down the list, Justin Harmon off the bench had 20 points. He went 4 of 5 from three. The team as a whole went 10 of 18. They shot 56% from beyond the arc. Mm-hmm. But here's what I want to point out, Sam.
Yeah.
And this is what I think is interesting. Quincy Guerrier, 35 minutes. Coleman Hawkins, 35 minutes. Marcus Damask, 35 minutes. Three players played 35 minutes. Luke Goody, 32 minutes. Ty Rogers only played 19 minutes. He's the lowest on the starters, but he also had 4 fouls. So 19 minutes for Ty Rogers. And then Justin Harmon off the bench, 29 minutes. The rest of the bench players, their action is as follows. Hansberry, 3 minutes. Danger, 4 minutes. AJ Red, 1 minute. Williams, 1 minute. And then somebody else that I can't see the name for whatever reason, 6 minutes. Like, only one player off the bench played more than 6 minutes. Rotation-wise, depth-wise, this is shrinking quickly on Illinois.
That's dangerous for Illinois, because you get a team like, and I hate doing it because it's my team, but you put a team like Purdue on the court. So tonight, that rotation, I don't know, is going to be able to hold against Purdue.
Because Purdue's so deep.
That's what I'm getting at, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there are 3 starters from last year, Dalton, that are off the bench now for Purdue.
Yep.
Like, that's they're still on the team. I mean, Purdue only had 1 transfer out from last year. And so, like, everybody's bought in, at least to this point, their role on the team. And that includes 3 guys that were in the starting lineup last year that are now coming off the bench and fighting to get minutes. They're getting minutes, but is Illinois going to be able to throw more into the rotation and give themselves a chance against a team like Purdue? I don't know. I don't know that they can do it.
No, I think it's a very fair point. And so that one tips tonight from Mackey Arena at 8:30. It'll be on FS1, but Purdue's favored by 10.5 points. If you look at the ESPN analytics, they favor Purdue about 77.5%, saying that they should win that game. And by all means,
they should.
Mm-hmm.
They should.
But again, we should mention Illinois, number 9 in the country. I don't want that to get kind of floated under. Illinois is having a great year, but without Shannon Jr., there are still question marks, even though they did get a pretty impressive win over Northwestern without
Would
him
I be shocked game. If Illinois won tonight? No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't be 100% shocked. I'd be like, whoa, they beat him without Terrence Shannon Jr., but I wouldn't be like flabbergasted, like, oh my gosh, they lost to Northwestern. You know, it wouldn't be as shocking.
I think I'm in the same boat as you with that.
I don't expect it, though.
Yeah. For the weekend, games that are interesting, Nebraska plays number 21 Wisconsin tomorrow. That's at 2:15. I mean, the Tomi Naga show takes on Madison, Wisconsin. And Nebraska had an impressive one last time out. They played Indiana. Excuse me. That was on Wednesday. They beat the Hoosiers by 16. And Tomi Naga finished with 28 points. I'm pulling it up now. 28 points in that game.
Nothing makes me happier than seeing IU lose. So that's always a plus. I think Nebraska is going to be a lot better than what maybe they were being portrayed to being in this season, where they were prognosticated to be maybe. But they're going to beat some teams, especially going out to Lincoln. They're going to beat some teams that they shouldn't. And Purdue's got that coming up here soon, and they need to watch out, because you don't want to get Casey bitten.
Yeah, no, it's not wrong. And it's interesting too, looking at the box score, like Indiana shot 50% from three, 47% from floor, from the floor. Nebraska shot 37.5% from three and 46% from the field and beat them by 16.
Yeah. Like comfortably.
Nebraska doesn't have to play their best game anymore to beat you. And I think one, because I'm a bit of personally a fan of him, Fred Hoiberg finally getting a really good group to put together. That makes me pretty happy for what's coming together there in Nebraska. And that's a fun team to root for and watch.
As long as it's not against Purdue, I'm rooting for them.
Well, they take on Wisconsin, as we said, 2:15 tomorrow. Yeah. That should be a pretty interesting game. I actually don't even see a spread posted for that one yet. I'd be kind of curious what that lands on. But Wisconsin had a pretty impressive win earlier this week. Also, they defeated Iowa 83-72 on Tuesday. I was trying to find the date. Saturday also, Ohio State plays Indiana. Again, Indiana reeling a little bit. You heard head coach Mike Woodson after that game say the two guards were awful for Indiana against Nebraska. Really kind of railed against the perimeter play. They have Ohio State have to bounce back at 8 o'clock Saturday night. That's going to be a tough challenge, especially given the fact that Ohio State's led by the backcourt and Bruce Thornton and Gale.
Yeah. Well, and that's the key is, you know, does Ohio State, are they playing at a level, which I think they are at this point, comparative to IU, to where they can go into Bloomington and win? Because it's still very, very difficult to win at the Assembly Hall. It just is. And, you know, that's a built-in home court advantage that is always going to be there for IU. You know, so if you've got a team that's comparative, and I'm not sure if you froze up there, you are. You froze for a second. I thought you were in deep thought with me. but, you know, I think Ohio State, you know, we've talked about them and what they've got. They're a sneaky good team, and they're going to, I think they're exactly like Nebraska, to where if you take them lightly, they're going to shock you. And yep. I think Ohio State could, you know, I hate IU, but I'm trying to be as objective as possible. And I think, but with them playing as poorly as they did against Nebraska, they need to watch out or they're going to get two in a row, because Ohio State is playing pretty decently right now. They've got won four in a row.
Well, you talk about trying to be objective, although there are fan interests and allegiances that exist. Switching over to me, the Michigan Wolverines basketball team.
Yeah.
Last night they took on Minnesota, and I said we wanted to get to this game. Minnesota hangs on to win at 73-71 in Ann Arbor. Michigan now falls to 6-8 on the season. Doug McDaniel had a shot at the buzzer to try and tie it and send it into overtime. The floater just didn't quite hit, and Minnesota hangs on. Big win for Ben Johnson and the Gophers. Yeah. But on the Michigan side, again, trying to take away any fan allegiances or interests or whatever away, what Michigan basketball showing and expressing right now, not just from like in between the lines on court product, but everything else, it's concerning.
Yeah, they have two separate losing streaks of three or more. Would have been six in a row had they not beaten Stanford, but they beat Stanford because, you know, Long Beach State, Memphis, then beat Stanford, then Texas Tech, Oregon, Indiana, all three of them lost in a row. Then they win a couple against Iowa, Eastern Michigan. Now back to Florida. McNeese? They lost to McNeese? And then Minnesota. Now, you sit there and look at Minnesota, and they've been a dumpster fire the past 2 years. Now, it looks like maybe Michigan's there because, I don't know, Minnesota is – Ben Johnson, I really like him as a coach, because to have – be doing what he was doing – he's been doing with a Gopher team that has lost their best player to Ohio State – and they're sitting at 11-3, 2-1 in the Big Ten, six in a row. Have I bought into the Gophers? Not necessarily as the, you know, Northwestern from last year, but I think they're going to be a little bit better than what they were. Well, they're going to be a lot better than what they have been in the past.
And I think that's fair. I kind of root for Ben Johnson too. I think he does a lot of things the right way. But on the Michigan side, and what I would maybe say best to do if you're listening to this and you want a more clear picture on maybe what's happening with Michigan basketball, Sleepers Media did a nice reporting piece last night. I saw from their car at midnight talking about being at that game and just observing what they noticed from body language. And again, not so much X's and O's type stuff, but just how people are interacting with each other in the program. And again, what he says from Sleepers Media in that piece, again, there's a lot of concerning issues that reside there. So I don't know what we're going to get from Michigan basketball the rest of the way. And especially if things are as discombobulated and disjointed as they seem, I really just don't know how you even turn it around in the Big Ten. I think they might be in for a very long 2 months.
I think I'm looking at one stat right now, Dalton, for Michigan that tells me that it's going to be a very, very long season for them. They are 3-4 at home.
Yeah.
That's before you've only played three Big Ten games and you already have 4 losses at home at the Chrysler Arena. That tells me it's going to be a long season if you're losing that many games already at home.
And if teammates aren't really getting together or getting along and things like that are going on, right, like the observations from Sleepers Media, that could be a tough stretch. But
it could turn, Sam, it could turn into a bigger dumpster fire before too long.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and switch over to women's basketball for a moment here, because there was a lot to break down from the week that was. Of course, the viral moment that went across was Caitlin Clark being Caitlin Clark once more, hitting a step-back game winner in Iowa City to defeat Michigan State 76-73. I have some thoughts on this one that maybe zags against the media's zig in coverage, and maybe this is also me being a homer. But
okay, fair enough.
I came away from that game more impressed about Michigan State women's basketball and where that program is under year one under head coach Robin Fralich than anything necessarily positive with Iowa. That's not taking anything away from Iowa. I just think Caitlin Clark is capable of those shots. We know that. I think it's impressive that Michigan State defensively forced her to get her 40 points on 34 shots. They wanted to take other players away, and they effectively did so. Iowa took 67 shots in this game. Caitlin Clark took 34 of them.
Wow. Wow. That's a lot of shots to force the superstar to get her points. And correct, from my understanding, that I'm never the one to say officiating determines the outcome. It helps, though. It does help. And some of the calls that I've been made aware that happened, to me, a couple of the graphics that I saw or the clips that I saw, there wasn't a 3-point shot taken, but yet there were 3 foul shots granted.
Yeah.
You know, that there are so many other things that could go into. And that wasn't even Caitlin Clark going to the line for those 3. That was somebody else.
In case somebody missed it, I'll explain. So with 20-some seconds left, 30-some seconds left, it was tied up 71-71. Molly Davis gave a shot fake from the left wing. Dee Dee Hageman came flying out on the contest. Davis saw her, instantly took a dribble to the left, and that's when Hageman collided with her. I obviously have different allegiances or interests. I don't know how, like, I think that's as clear as a on the floor foul. And it's certainly a foul, like no mistake about it.
Sure, sure.
But it was not a shooting foul. Now, to your point, Molly Davis then goes to the line. She hits 2 out of 3. They take a 73-71 lead. Michigan State counters in the final 15, 20 seconds with a layup of their own to tie it back up, setting up the eventual Caitlin Clark game winner. So if that gets called on the floor, I don't know if the outcome changes or not, but that was just
if there's enough question, you don't know.
That was just a brutal call. I mean, even as a neutral observer, and it received a lot of criticism from Dawn Staley and other like top women's basketball people that reacted to that one and said that was just rough. And again, I don't know if it changes the outcome or not, but it just It just was a rough
call. It sure doesn't seem like it's giving the proper chance to come out the way that you know. I mean, that just seemed like that was such an egregious call. I was watching this and I'm like, okay, there's the pump fake. There's the shot fake. Okay, she's dribbling. Oh my goodness, they called that a shooting foul. She like didn't even have the ball in the air. Like she was dribbling the ball when she got fouled. That's the most. But I can see what you're talking about. Is Michigan State took more out of that loss than Iowa took out of that win, because Iowa should have won. Iowa should have. They're number four. They should win at home against a Michigan State team that last year struggled. You know, granted, Michigan State's a lot better than what they appeared to have been last year. Mm-hmm. But at the same point, those are teams Iowa should win against pretty more convincingly than not. And for the fact that it took a last-second shot on her 34th shot to win the game against Michigan State says a lot about the Spartans.
Yeah, I think a lot of that had to do with what Mo Joyner was doing to her all game. I mean, just all over her. I mean, Michigan State, if you have not been watching Michigan State or taking them in some form, it's a good time to jump on the wagon, because what Robin Fralick's building here is, I think, going to be pretty special. I mean, given the fact of if you experience the games and you see how they play, it's very team oriented. Mo Joyner, who leads the team with 16 points a game, she was averaging 9 to 10 last year. Abby Kimball averages 10-11 points a game. She was averaging 2 or 3 last year. Julia Arault was averaging about 3 points a game. She's averaging like 15 points and 7.5 rebounds. She's also number one in the Big Ten in blocked shots. Like, there are a lot of players that are taking giant jumps under Robin Fralick. And a lot of it, I think, is a byproduct of the system and how connected everything is. It's a fun experience. It's a fun team to kind of get in here on ground floor and ride with through the rest of the way. But I think it proved a lot, too, because a lot of people were curious of what Michigan State women's basketball was. The non-conference wasn't maybe the strongest. And right. So there were numbers put up that were gaudy. I mean, Michigan State's averaging 94 points a game, 93 points per game. And a lot of the question marks are sitting there like, how good is Michigan State really? They look at the net. They see Michigan State number 14, number 15. They're like, okay, what's going on with the formula where it's respecting Michigan State so much? And I think that game nationally proved to a lot of people that Michigan State is deserving of some of this conversation. And heading into the year, I think a lot of people had Michigan State 10th, 9th in the Big Ten standings before we tipped this off. And now I think you can recalibrate the ceiling for what Michigan State women's basketball can be, given what we've seen through the first 14 games of the year. Like, this team absolutely can make a run to get to the postseason. Which,
are they a top six team in the conference?
I think their ceiling is. I think their ceiling, if they, again, this is a team that's already dealt 2 season-ending injuries. Yeah. The rotation's pretty thin. Depth is thin. So, I mean, given what happens, it's going to be kind of tough to evaluate. But their ceiling, absolutely. Especially given what the rest of the Big Ten is. I mean, if we talk about some of the other games that have happened, Michigan, they go on the road. Or no, was that on the
road? No, it was at home against Ohio State.
Is at home against Ohio State. Thank you. They defeat Ohio State, and then they go to play Indiana at Indiana and lose 80-59.
Right.
And this is the same Michigan team that lost to Toledo earlier this year. Like, I don't really know what Michigan is to this point.
And it's definitely not what we expected from Ohio State.
Correct. And I think, I mean, you know, naturally with Big Ten play, you're just going to see this in some regards, right? I mean, these teams drop a couple once, but Michigan at its best, pretty solid team.
Yeah.
But it just looks like things are a bit streakier with Michigan, depending on what you end up getting from them. Maryland's not ranked for the first time in 13 years. I still don't think they're a bad team. But I don't fully know what they are.
What about Illinois too? They're a better team than what they're showing right now. They're 6-6 overall, 0-2 in the Big Ten. Like that to me is not necessarily, well, yeah, probably the biggest shock of the teams in the Big Ten right now.
And it's funny too, because this is just second year for Shauna Greene there at Illinois. In year one, she did the unthinkable. Honestly, right. Terry Morin won Big Ten Coach of the Year, and deservingly so. But I thought Shauna Greene was deserving of that as well. Taking a program that hadn't been in the tournament, and I can't even remember
20 years,
how
years wasn't it?
It's something like that.
It
I mean,
around
it's
the turn of the century, believe it or not.
Yeah. And got them ranked. I mean, did a lot of great things. They've taken a bit of a step back, as you mentioned, but they also battled Indiana to a one possession game at Indiana. So again, Illinois is another one of those teams. Like there's a jump or a bundle of teams in the middle of the Big Ten that you really don't know consistently what you're going to get from. And I think that makes all of this math pretty difficult.
It's going to make this conference season a fantastic one to watch.
Absolutely.
It's going to make it so much fun to watch.
Yes. I think it's going to be an exhilarating year of basketball. It's just hard to project.
It's going
to
play hell on us projecting, but
yes,
it will 100. Be fun to watch.
Well, real quick before we close out, we'll go ahead and mention some of the games that are coming up on the women's side. Because as we mentioned, it was a pretty big week in Big Ten women's basketball. And again, a lot of national attention to the Big Ten conference. Number 4, Iowa plays Rutgers tonight at 6. Rutgers has been struggling. Number 20, Ohio State's at Northwestern. Northwestern's been struggling. That's at 8 o'clock. Right now, I think Rutgers-Northwestern kind of at the bottom. I think those
are the two bottom teams right now in the Big Ten.
Those are some tough challenges for them. Purdue's at Maryland tomorrow at 4:30. Purdue hung on to win on Tim Newton night. Tim Newton called his 1,000th game.
Wow, good for him.
Women's basketball on the radio. That was pretty cool to see. So that's on Saturday. Then Sunday, here's where some games get a little bit interesting. Wisconsin goes to Illinois at 3 o'clock. Again, we talked about Illinois. You're still kind of trying to figure out what exactly they are.
Well, and Wisconsin's struggling too this year, at least in the Big Ten.
Well, and they're still trying to climb a little bit. Sarah Williams, a sophomore, has been kind of their star, I suppose you could say. But they're still in the early juncture of building the program that they want. But the big one I think that you're mentioning is at 2 o'clock on Sunday. It's number 14 Indiana at Nebraska. And I think if you're looking for a classic post matchup, Mackenzie Holmes versus Alexis Markowski, here's your game.
That's it. That's why I was getting it. Nebraska is a lot better. Unbelievably, Nebraska, this is the year of the Cornhusker in basketball, evidently, because they're playing very solid basketball in Lincoln right now. And for that, IU needs to watch out, because while they're sitting pretty right now, you could go to Lincoln and leave with an L, and it's not out of the question or a realm of possibility.
Indiana started to get some improved play from many different players. They had three different players score 30 points in three games in a row. Sarah Scalia stepped up in a big way. Yarden Garzone starting to figure it out maybe a little bit. Chloe Moore McNeil starting to get into the scoring column a little bit more. And on the Nebraska side, we haven't even mentioned Jazz Shelley, who had a triple-double a month ago and has been putting up
some got a triple-double.
Yeah, so I think I'm with you. That should be a tremendous matchup, 2 o'clock on Sunday. But with that being said, we need to get out of here. We only got a couple minutes left. So for Sam Sprunger, I'm Dalton Shetler. And Sam, go ahead and let everybody know where they can find us.
Yeah, on the TikToks, the Instagrams, and the platform formerly known as Twitter. It's at B1G underscore talk. B1G underscore talk, not B-I-G. Dalton, B1G underscore talk. Facebook, B1G talk. Big Talk. Do not go to All Big Talk. That's not us. We're just Big Talk. Every week we're on the ASAP network. Every week on Friday from 9 to 10. You know that because you're watching it right now and it's just turned 10. and then later that day on Lounge Media Group through Lounge Media Group, and very soon we will be on Lounge Media Group Radio.
Awesome.
Everywhere else you can find where you find podcasts.
Perfect. Well, thank you all again so much for tuning in and joining us for this edition of big talk. And by the way, a happy New Year's to all of you. Haven't had a chance. This is the first episode in 2024. So ringing it in style.
Happy 2024, Sam. Folks.
That's Sam Sprunger. I'm Dalton Shetler. So long, everybody.
See ya.